Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 2010, Abby Norman was a sophomore at Sarah Lawrence College on scholarship with hopes of a future career in dance. All of that changed during a routine shower when pain took hold of her body. Norman was forced to withdraw from Sarah Lawrence, and the pain also drove her into a raft of emergency rooms and doctor's offices. But physician after physician either misdiagnosed, undermined, or made her believe she was imagining the symptoms. She was eventually diagnosed with a very serious ailment of endometriosis. She wrote about her experience and the gender bias in medicine in her new memoir. It's titled, Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You know, Abby, I told you before we went onto the air, I wanted to dedicate this to my sister, Carol, because she had, as I read the book, an eerily similar experience. I won't go into it. It's personal. But you said, you told me that this is happening over and over and over again. You're hearing this story.
Yeah, I mean, it really started for me prior to even when the book came out about a month ago now. When I started telling this story on the broader internet or writing about my experience, I started to get emails or messages from women all over the world, but particularly, in the United States. And that has only really just kind of spiraled in the last month or so now that the book is out. And what's remarkable to me is not so much the number of messages that I get or the number of emails that I get, because I think on some level especially as I was researching the book, I started to understand sort of the breadth of this problem and the numbers, are intense. What struck me is that the stories are always the same.
Yeah.
They almost follow a narrative pattern. There's this encounter, this experience of starting to interact with the healthcare system, and then it's almost as though women have to go through this very kind of specific pattern of interaction. They're dismissed, they're doubted, and then maybe eventually they're blamed, and it all they have to go through all of these trials before anyone even seems to feel as though they are worthy of having a more thorough evaluation of their pain or their symptoms. And that's what really has struck me about this, is just the consistency of the stories.
And by the way, a lot of these kinds of issues tend to focus on women in a certain age group. They're younger, they're more naive, they're not as worldly, they don't maybe have the chops yet to get entangled in that dynamic with doctors.
Well, I think actually what's been the most interesting for me is that I started writing this book when I was 24. Mm-hmm. I just turned 27. So I really expected that the response would mostly come from women in my demographic. That's really what I expected.
Okay.
And I have to tell you that what really has startled me is that I would say the more fervent emails that I get or messages that I get actually come from women in my mother's generation. Mm-hmm. Women who have been struggling really in silence for 20, 30 years, and they've really reached a point where, their focus has been, well, I was trying to raise a family, I was trying to have a career, and, these issues weren't getting addressed for me even, 20 years ago, and now I've had to try to fit it into my life somehow. I've had to struggle through this. And so I was not really prepared for that. I mean, I really did think that it was something that maybe was really primarily focused with this demographic of younger women who perhaps don't feel that they can, challenge the dynamic or that the power dynamic is intimidating to them. And I'm not sure that's the truth, really. I think it's a problem that seems to be really running the gamut in terms of demographic, in terms of not just age, but I would say socioeconomic circumstances as well.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about gender bias in medicine, and in particular today with reference to pain. My guest is Abby Norman. She's a science journalist and author of a new book. It's a memoir. It's entitled Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. And listeners, we want to hear from you today. If you have a story to tell about your experience with a physician not believing you when you tried to tell him that you were having pain, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, for me, this is a different sort of a take, even though it's sort of glaringly obvious. When I talk about gender bias a lot in medicine, the conversation usually revolves around the dearth of medical research on women, the extrapolation of research on men to women's health, and that kind of a thing. But you look at attitudes about women's health in a different way than that, and you take it from a wholly different approach, and that is just about whether doctors believe women when they describe their symptoms.
Yes, and I think that the research component is certainly very important.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this issue is incredibly complex. What was really more interesting, I think, to me, because, of course, I always say, you know, I'm not a doctor and I'm not a scientist. I might have been had my education not been interrupted. You know, I may have done any number of things. But for me, just sort of personally, I think I was more interested in sort of the broader sociocultural perception of women. And I think that right now what's so interesting is that when I originally pitched this book 2 years ago, we were in a very different sociopolitical climate.
Hmm.
And the world into which I was beginning to research and write this book is very, very different from the world that it's been published into. So this whole sort of broader cultural uprising in it, you know, the whole like Me Too movement and mm-hmm. this idea that that women are not believed initially when they say any number of things or when they assert any number of experiences that they've had, particularly those that are around their body. I mean, it really does come back to this much more ingrained sort of cultural experience and cultural perception. And I think that, you know, maybe we like to think that medicine is much more beholden to like the scientific principles that govern how those dynamics function or what those experiences for patients are like, because, you know, they're supposed to be sort of operating within the realm of like science and fact. And I think that it's more subtle than that. I think that those interactions are certainly influenced and can vary a great deal depending on where a patient is seeking care. You know, there's an enormous difference, not just in terms of research and medical science, if you're in a sort of, you know, rural hospital versus a, you know, the Mayo Clinic, but also, you know, what that doctor's experience is just in terms of, you know, working with a much broader range of patients. So I think that we have to kind of really look at it and look at medicine as a whole as being having that sort of cultural subtlety there that to me as a patient was really in the end, I think, what felt the most stark to me. And when I hear women talk about their experiences personally, you know, they're not necessarily coming in armed with research, and they're not necessarily being given actionable information. But what they are taking away is that feeling of their doctor thinking that they were making it up for attention, or their doctor insisting that they have to try an antidepressant before they'll even do a scan
mm-hmm.
because they're convinced that they're having you know, a difficult time with work, or maybe they're having a problem with their marriage, or maybe they're stressed out because of, you know, their children going through something. So there's this sort of impetus on the patient to prove not just that she's not lying,
mm-hmm.
but that she's deserving of having medical care. And I think that to me, I mean, I felt at the beginning, you know, I felt like, oh, I must be doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, you know, this is happening to me in these encounters because I'm not communicating something correctly.
Well, you know, and by the way, you denied yourself for a week or two, right?
Oh, I did. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's
part of the problem.
We're taught to
right.
buck up, get over it.
Yes, absolutely. Or just that I think there was for me as well. I always say that and I've heard this from many women, there's this sort of trenchant doubt that a lot of us tend to carry about our own perceptions of our own experience. There's this question of, am I really in this much pain, or am I just being weak? Or even if I am in this much pain, you know, should I be able to still go to work? Should I be able to get up and, you know, do a load of laundry? Like, you know, there's this whole idea of us feeling as though we need to question it, you know, that, that there perhaps is, you know, something that has been given to us or taught to us and passed on, you know, culturally for us that we've internalized that makes us doubt ourselves first. And it makes it all the more difficult when we finally do end up in the emergency room or go to a doctor's office, because really, I think at that point, you know, we've already started this encounter and what is going to be a difficult encounter for many women. And we're already exhausted by the time we even get there.
Tell us, what did doctors initially tell you about your condition?
Well, when I first was trying to even just, you know, seek care in an emergency room setting, I really came up first against, well, you know, you're a young college age girl, so this is really like a stress manifestation. You know, this is that you're stressed out. And once it sort of got through that, then it was a series of misdiagnoses going according to, well, you're a young college age girl, so it's probably, you know, an STD. And I said, well, I'm not having sex. I'm actually a virgin, so I'm pretty sure it's not that. And I'm also probably not pregnant, because that would be like kind of
biblical,
miraculous
if
that was the case. Yeah. And then it sort of went down to the next tier, which was, well, okay, it's a UTI. So here's some antibiotics and some cranberry juice.
Urinary tract infection, right, yeah.
Right. So it sort of went, you know, sort of the gamut of those sort of things. And I think that as time went on and I sort of went through this process, you know, this whole idea that it was so difficult for me to figure out what I was, you know, what the doctor wanted from me in terms of like, how was I talking about my pain or talking about, you know, the other symptoms that had become at that point, you know, chronic. So I was also very nauseated. I lost a lot of weight initially, just from being very like ill, just having a very ill feeling all the time. Mm-hmm. And was increasingly getting weak from that, you know, just being in pain. You know, and having those symptoms, and then having this feeling that if I was too confident or if I was too eager to explain what my symptoms were and how long they've been going on, that somehow invalidated me. But then if I went in and had an encounter with a physician where I wasn't particularly forthcoming and they had to, you know, and mostly that was because I was so tired, uh-huh. You know, I was just, or I didn't feel well and I wasn't doing a very good job of communicating. That didn't help me either. And I really had a number of encounters where I would just feel like it was a very much, like a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. You know, I just didn't feel like there was anything that I could do that seemed to be helpful to me. And there was one point, and this is, you know, this I talk about it in the book, but even after I had had a surgery wherein the whole, you know, it's like, oh, well, there's the endometriosis and there's this cyst, and I don't know how we didn't see this on a scan because this cyst is, you know, it's twisted your tube out of alignment and all of this. You know, sort of what happened from there is that wasn't the end of it. It was only really the beginning of the physical problems that I had. But I had to start the process all over again, because then I had issues that had sprung up in my gastrointestinal tract. And in the months that eventually became years that I started trying to have the same kind of, you know, quest to get to the bottom of that, I had a surgeon very blatantly tell me that because I had had a somewhat difficult childhood and that I had had some traumatic things happen to me in my youth, that his opinion was that this very specific abdominal pain that I had that was located in just one spot, it wasn't diffuse or vague, it was very specific. He thought that it was the psychological manifestation of trauma that was probably sexual that I just didn't remember. And I honestly, in that moment, in that encounter, had absolutely no idea what I could possibly say to that. I mean, I was like, how could I possibly say anything in that moment in response to that would challenge it or that would try to, you know, I mean, I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say about it.
Right.
I didn't know what I was, to me, somebody who wasn't, I mean, he wasn't a psychologist. He was a surgeon, you know, and I just thought, what am I supposed to, what could I possibly say to that? And how do you know, where do I go from here? Hmm. And it wasn't until, you know, almost, well, about a year later when the situation became very acute that I finally had surgery. And at that point, it turned out that I'd had an appendix that had been inflamed for about 18 months and had become totally enmeshed in my intestine and adhered to the rest of the structures there. And, you know, had it ruptured, I would have died. And it, you know, to me, I knew that there was something wrong. I knew there was something in my body that shouldn't be there. But no one, you know, I never seemed to be able to say the right thing to get somebody to think that I was telling the truth.
We're talking about women and pain in the medical profession. My guest is Abby Norman. She's a science journalist and the author of a new book. It's a memoir. It's titled Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. Coming up, we'll hear from a professor of health law from the University of Maryland who has also written extensively and studied this issue. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on the 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 2001, Diane Hoffman co-authored the groundbreaking study titled The Girl Who Cried Pain, A Bias Against Women in the Treatment of Pain. The study analyzed how gender bias plays out in clinical pain management. And 17 years later, Abby Hoffman's new book is published. The title is Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. We're talking about gender bias in medical care today. Still with us by phone is science journalist and author Abby Norman. And joining us as well by phone is co-author of The Girl Who Cried Pain, professor of health law and director of the Law and Healthcare Program at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, Diane Hoffman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Wow, 18 years, a couple of generations of physicians, and yet Abby Norman has reported that doctors are stunned when they hear her speak about this issue. What is the deal, Diane Hoffman?
Well, there have been studies indicating that, in fact, physicians have treated men and women differently with respect to complaints of pain. We know from the biology and physiology that women and men are different, and they experience pain differently. Women tend to have sometimes people, I think it's the other way around, but women have lower pain thresholds and lower pain tolerance than do men in terms of research that's been done on that in response to painful stimuli. So there are these differences, and one would expect that we would see differences in how men or how physicians respond to men and women in terms of their pain. But we would expect to see it the other way, that they pay more attention and are more aggressive treating women than men. But yet, the studies indicate it's been the other way, that physicians have been less likely to believe women, attribute their complaints of pain more to emotions than to real physical pain.
I want to bring in a caller right now who's in the medical profession. Mary in Columbus, I know you have to get to work, so I wanted to bring you in. Tell us what you know. Hi, Mary.
Thank you, Ann.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate the work you're doing and for giving women a voice. And so I would just like to say I've witnessed this for 25 years, that women who give birth or have cesarean sections or just have complaints of pain, it could even be that your mood is changing, that they go under a kind of a field of neglect. And then they're like I liked how the one author said that there's almost a script for this. There's a narration for how this plays out. What I see is over time, though, when these women, they are quiet, they don't have much of a voice, they are ignored. If they're given answers, it's typically pharmacy, and it's get on a website and kind of figure it out yourself. I just like to say to younger women, I don't think we should perpetuate that. There's a lot of do-it-yourself, find-it-out-yourself stuff going on now that kind of eliminates the medical practitioner from having to be really creative and really dig in and individualize to that woman's needs at that time. To keep speaking up to the medical community. When they say you have a cesarean section and it's major surgery, that's serious. So then you should have the appropriate instructions for how to take care of yourself with that major surgery when you get home. And that's really lacking in the medical profession for women.
Wow.
I see women in their 50s being exhausted managing all this.
Yeah, well,
managing the pharmacy. They have raised their family.
Yeah, well, Abby Norman, you mentioned that you were surprised when we started writing about this, that the people responding to it tended to be older.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the demographic of women who feel the depth of the silencing, I mean, I really expected it would be women more in my demographic, but really the most impassioned letters and messages that I've gotten have come from women who are now in their middle age and for whom these issues really began, you know, when they were my age, but that was 20 some years ago.
Right. Diane Hoffman, what is the legal component to all of this? Is there a piece in there for women to, is there a legal remedy for some of this?
Unfortunately, not really. I mean, unless you can show malpractice in the sense that the physician didn't conform to a standard of care, didn't adequately do the tests that someone would do for a patient coming in with certain complaints. There's not a legal remedy for discrimination or something like that. That it's very difficult to show that this was it's intentional type of discrimination. Huh. So short of malpractice or the other thing that women can do if they feel like they're really being the physician is not competent or he's rude and dismissive is contact their state medical licensing board. And it has to be really unprofessional conduct that would lead to some kind of disciplinary action or sanction.
Mary, by the way, in Columbus, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. You know, when I hear you talk, Diane Hoffman, then I'm starting to think about all of the victims of Larry Nassar at Michigan State University and how many times they tried to say, this doesn't feel right what you're doing. This hurts. Abby Norman, this had to be kind of resonating for you at this point in your life.
Oh, yes, deeply. And I think that, you know, for me, particularly just in the context of when, like I said, you know, sort of the world into which this book has been published and that I'm having these conversations, which primarily just by virtue of the internet, sort of the way that all of these stories can be disseminated much more widely. I mean, I sit and I look at Twitter and I watch the news and I hear these stories. And there's a part of me, of course, that just isn't surprised at all. You know, there's, of course, this other piece that wants to say, okay, well, you know, now we're having these conversations. We're putting these things out there. We are, you know, demanding better treatment. We're demanding to be listened to and to be heard. And I can't help but feel like it's going to be, you know, somewhat of a long and uphill battle to continue to advocate for that, only because through my book and through the research I've done, it's just very clear that we didn't get here overnight. You know, there's a precedent culturally, but also in medicine, that has been building for a very, very long time. So, I mean, I want to say that I feel confident that we can change the dialogue, and that we're in the process of doing that in a much broader cultural sense as well. But I would say it's a cautious optimism.
Well, Diane Hoffman, what has changed since the 2001 study, The Girl Who Cried Pain?
Great question. You know, it's been a while, and I haven't looked at the I'm just starting to collect some additional literature, and there is quite a bit on more on the understanding of pain. I think that we're learning more and more about different kinds of pain and things that we didn't know before, and more. There's also been more research on women. Remember that there was a time historically that research wasn't really done on women. They were a category of subjects that was thought to be, we shouldn't do research on them because they could get pregnant, and then there might be some harm done to the fetus. So it wasn't until the 1990s that we started to, that was changed, and NIH started scrutinizing research and saying, you have to do more research on women. So I think we're finding out more about how women respond to different kind of drugs and other interventions. We're learning about different kinds of pain like fibromyalgia and crips and things that we didn't know a lot about before. We're learning about centralized sensitization in terms of the changes in the brain that are happening. And one of the things that I think it may be a reason why physicians do respond differently for women and men is that they learned about medicine and mostly on men in terms of what we know about how men respond to pain and how and injury and less on women. And so pain is incredibly complex, and we're just we are just learning about how it affects us. And remember that it's not something that you can easily measure, and there's no objective test for pain. Scientists are starting to look at the brain and do fMRIs, which do show changes in the brain based on chronic for people who have chronic pain. They're seeing differences. So when women have come to physicians, I think they have often had some of these more complex pain conditions that are still somewhat controversial, although I think there's much more wider acceptance of things like fibromyalgia in the medical community. But those things are hard to diagnose, and they're usually diagnosed by exclusion rather than a real test that can determine whether
they're hard to diagnose, but what do we know about why doctors are content with disbelieving then?
I don't.
That's the missing kind of link. Like, don't worry, we won't give up until we figure out what's wrong. And instead of just sending you away with a prescription for Xanax.
Right. I mean, I don't know exactly if there is nothing else that they feel like they can do. If they haven't done any testing haven't seen the medical records of the woman, I think that's a problem, that they don't believe them at the start. It's my understanding of more what is likely to happen is that there are tests that are done, and then there are no results, and then they stop, and they don't believe the woman that she's still in pain, and that there may be something else.
Yeah.
Either they're not familiar with the literature, haven't treated a patient like this before.
Yeah, you know, Abby Norman, that was shocking about yours is how long it took them to actually do tests.
Yeah, and, you know, to that point, one of the things that I've come to sort of understand about this in terms of the culture of medicine and where that plays in, one of the things as time went on and I sort of was having these interactions very consistently, I started to notice that usually, really, what it seemed like was that that doctors just really did not want to admit that they didn't know or that they didn't have an answer. And I have to say that as a patient, you know, I understood that the situation had reached a point of being somewhat complex, and I would have welcomed a physician saying, you know, I really don't know, but I think that you could go to perhaps someone in this discipline, or you could do, you know, you could do this other thing and maybe you'd get the answer. But instead of doing that, that would be the point at which they would say, well, you must be making it up because I can't figure it out. Mm-hmm. And to me as a patient, I would have much rather have, and I would have accepted, because doctors are human, and you know, that I don't think most of us expect, you know, that a doctor knows everything. Certainly not that they would know, you know, every ailment of every possible, specialty, because mm-hmm. most of the doctors we see, even if they're general practitioners and they've got a wealth of experience with many different things, no one's an expert in everything. So, I mean, I never went in and expected that a doctor would know everything. But in that moment, or in that period where all of a sudden there was this feeling that they had reached the end of their knowledge base, or they no longer felt they had the resources or the support from within the healthcare system in which they were trying to work to continue to try to work with me in some way to solve the issue, that it was just, maybe it was easier, or maybe it was more comfortable, or maybe it was at that point, maybe even not about me, but about them, and they're not wanting to feel that they had failed.
You know, another
in some way.
Another component of this, before I let Diane Hoffman go, I wanted you to talk about just the finances of it. Women tend to be less financially stable than men. In Abby Norman's case, she was on a form of Medicaid. Does that play a role in any of this, Diane Hoffman?
Well, that's not something that I looked at. I think that physicians, in terms of the way they are reimbursed, just generally, their incentives are to spend not much time with each patient, and to get through as many patients in a day as they can. That's often what the system in which they work requires of them. So that certainly attributes to a patient who is speaking and needs to telling a story, which a lot of women are tending to do. First of all, they have a long history because they haven't had any success getting their pain treated before coming to the doctor. And the doctors just maybe are feeling rushed as a result of the way that the reimbursement system works for them and the incentives that are created.
Okay, well, I was mistaken. Looks like Diane Hoffman is staying with us, which is good. We will continue our conversation with Diane Hoffman, professor of health law at the University of Maryland, and also Abby Norman, science journalist and author of a new memoir. It's entitled Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. If you want to join the conversation, we welcome it, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about gender bias in medicine and how women's pain is treated or not and diagnosed differently than men's. Still with us by phone is the author of a new book. It's titled Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain, Abby Norman. Also with us by phone is professor of health law and director of the law and healthcare program at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, Diane Hoffman. Professor Hoffman co-authored the groundbreaking study, The Girl Who Cried Pain, A Bias Against Women in the Treatment of Pain, in 2001. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Abby Hoffman, you talked about sort of the origins of how we measure pain, the one on a scale of 1 to 10. Where did that come from?
Well, I mean, there's a very long history of, sort of trying to quantify something that is somewhat, and I think, you know, certainly Diane spoke to this, but something that is kind of inherently subjective. Mm-hmm. So our experiences of pain are very much not just between us, very different, but even in terms of our experiences with pain throughout our lives. So, you know, as you have more painful experiences, your experience of pain is therefore, in terms of like being on a spectrum, you know, is going to adjust. So I was thinking specifically, you know, about how, you know, after my best friend had a baby, you know, her experience of pain became not just much more varied than mine, but even from her previous experiences of pain, she suddenly had a more extensive vocabulary for pain. And in fact, that was, you know, one place in which when scientists were trying to quantify it or find a way to scale it in some way that was more objective, there were researchers at Harvard in the 1940s who basically used women in the obstetric unit who were laboring as sort of willing mm-hmm. guinea pigs in a study to try to establish a more quantified pain scale. And they were ultimately not really successful in that, primarily because they found that, you know, once the women had gotten into a point in their labor where they were, you know, kind of struggling to adequately communicate the experience of the other painful stimuli that was being inflicted on them, you know, it became much more difficult for them to convey that experience or the subtleties of it, the nuances of the different types of pain, because they were in so much pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, pain, you know, that
I remember.
In and of itself, yeah. Right. It becomes very consuming.
Yeah.
And, you know, particularly, I think, you know, the next part of that is that when pain it becomes chronic, when it becomes daily, when it becomes something that becomes sort of like it has for me, just a part of your everyday life, that also then really changes your experience of pain. And I think also adds that whole other layer to it in terms of complexity.
There are people out there who live with chronic pain.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
I know it. I know it intellectually, but emotionally, it's hard to wrap my brain around that because I don't. Abby, is that your situation?
Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I was so young when this started.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still young.
Well, you're still young.
I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
I was 19 when it started, but really prior, it really for me had started even prior to that, because really it started with my very first menstrual period, because,
yeah,
you know, I didn't realize it until much later when I started to kind of put two and two together, but pain had become quite early in my life normalized, as I think it is for a lot of young women, around not just menstruation, but the way that we're set up to the way that, like, our future sexual relationships or our childbearing experiences, this is all something that we're taught very young is going to be sort of a necessary pain that is inevitable in some way. And I think that, you know, I hadn't quite realized until, you know, many years into this process where all of a sudden I realized that years had gone by and I had not been I hadn't had one day where I wasn't in pain. And then all of a sudden it's been almost 10 years and I realize that I don't really remember what it feels like to not be in pain. Yeah. You know, it really does cause, and I don't, you know, it becomes more than just a medical mystery or a medical issue to try to cope with. It really does become something much more expansive than that, because it challenges your self-perception. It certainly influences your social relationships, your work relationships, and it becomes something that, for me anyway, has been and it's sort of something I haven't wanted to become my whole identity. And I think that because I had this all happen at a point before I'd really even gotten to establish what my identity was, because mm-hmm. I was only 19, you know, it's really taken on this almost, you know, it's become a much bigger part of my life than I would have preferred, because there were a lot of other things that when I was 18 and 19 years old, you know, that I thought I would be spending my energy on, or that I thought I would be participating in. And there's so much of my life that, you know, things that I didn't even get to know that I couldn't experience, or that I wouldn't experience, that were kind of taken out of the running for me because this happened. And I think that that too is something that I hear a lot when women tell me their story, no matter what age they are, but particularly if they are a little bit older, or if they're a generation or two removed from me. You know, there is this idea of framing it as, you know, here are all the things that I've missed out on, or here are all the things that have become tainted in some way, because pain has always just been a part of my life.
Diane Hoffman, when you studied this in 2001, or when you published the paper in 2001, what did you learn that's still relevant today, 17 years later?
Well, I think that much of it is still relevant from mm-hmm. obviously Abby's story, yeah. that we certainly, and certainly the science, I think, that we initially reported in terms of the differences between men and women and pain, not the biological, but also things, just coping mechanisms. I think that's still the same, that men and women tend to cope differently with pain. And the culture in which we live hasn't really changed all that much in the last 20 years in terms of how boys and girls are even raised, I think, with respect to pain. I think we've changed a number of things in the way we raised children, but I'm not sure that that message is different, where boys are taught to be more stoic and girls are okay with expressing their emotions. That may have changed a bit. I'm not sure. Some younger mothers maybe can speak to that. Mm-hmm. But and in terms of treatment, I'd like to think that things have changed, that physicians, especially the younger cohort of physicians coming out of medical school, are more sensitive to issues that women face and the kinds of painful conditions that they face, and that they are willing to listen to them and respond appropriately. But when I keep hearing stories like Abby's, and I still read the literature, and I have many different groups that I tie into of chronic pain patients, the women continue to tell these stories. So I'm not sure that a whole lot has changed.
Abby, you suffer with chronic pain. At what point did you decide that this was a story to tell? What inspired you to tell this story now?
Well, actually, several years ago, I spoke at a medical conference that was, for many years, was kind of like a yearly thing at Stanford. It was called Stanford Medicine X, and it was one of these conferences where they were really trying to give patients equal footing in terms of talking about, you know, sort of what the contemporary challenges are in healthcare and medicine in a very broad sense. And I was invited to speak and tell my story. And it was the first time that I really told my story to an audience of, like, patients and physicians at the same time.
Huh.
And so I had been speaking about it on the internet for in broad strokes, and specifically, I think, more to patients. But I had this experience of doing this, you know, telling my story in this lecture hall at Stanford, you know, and I had a physician come up to me after, and at first, the way he looked at me, I thought he was going to, like, read me out. You know, I thought he was going to, like, you know, get really angry with
pretty
me.
Pretty intense looking, yeah.
Yeah, he had a very intense expression on his face, and he didn't say anything for a second. And then, you know, his expression sort of changed a little bit, and he said, you know, I've been sitting here listening to you and listening to your story, and I just can't help but think about how many people I might have done this to and not realized. And that was incredibly powerful for me. That not just that there was a sense of like accountability, or that there was a sense that this had somehow shifted his paradigm,
mm-hmm.
And made him recognize that this is something that, you know, was perhaps even not just down to him personally, but that was a much more systemic issue, but that he took the time to tell me and to sort of like have me witness his awakening in a way,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so it, you know, from there, everything kind of happened sort of just, I don't know. I mean, it just seemed like it just felt like I had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I knew that it wasn't going to change anything for me. Like, it wasn't going to change my circumstances. It wasn't going to make me better. It wasn't going to take my pain away. But I just thought, oh, but if somebody feels helped, or if somebody's story doesn't end up like mine, then wouldn't that feel at least like I've done something, you know, that I've contributed something to this conversation that's meaningful?
You know, I sometimes joke that I think the species wouldn't survive if we could remember the pain we have giving birth. We wouldn't do it over and over again. And I think it was so significant that you also took notes and kept a journal during this time when you were very young.
I did. Yeah.
Otherwise, how would you remember? I mean, because you're in the thralls of all this pain, how would you remember?
Yeah, I'm so thankful. And it was funny because, you know, even as a very young preteen and a teenager, I mean, I joke now that I was just so like, you know, like pedantic, and I was just very much like kind of the bookworm type of kid. And I'm so thankful for that now. I mean, maybe I felt a little bit geeky and awkward at that point, as I'm sure most people do when they're like 14. But, you know, I'm so grateful for that now, because it allows me to have, you know, a much longer sort of narrative in terms of putting this into a much broader context in my own story, which has really resonated with people as well. But also for me personally to have maybe tried to start to arrive at some kind of peace with it all. For myself, you know, because I think, well, I'm 27 and, you know, I probably am going to, I would imagine, live for, you know, another so however many decades. And if, you know, if I hear from these women who are 20 or 30 years older than I am, that they've continued to live in pain for this long, that feels very difficult to face, to think about. And I think to myself, am I just going to live another 30, 40 years like this? You know, that feels like a lot to sit with. But then I look back at that and I think, yes, but I've already sort of done this to some extent. You know, it's mm-hmm. been almost 10 years since this started for me. And I have managed to have other things in my life other than pain. My whole life has not been solely about this. And I've managed to, you know, in my small way, you know, do something that feels like at least I've provided a tool. And like mm-hmm. I said, maybe it won't change my circumstances, but, you know, every time I get a message from somebody or an email from somebody, even though they've told me this story and they've explained the ways in which they've suffered that are so similar, they almost always end on a note of, you know, but thank you for telling your story, because for the first time in my life, I feel like validated, you know, I don't feel alone.
Abby Norman, her book is titled Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. Abby Norman, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Diane Hoffman, professor of health law and director of law and health care program at the University of Maryland. Thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.